and I thought we would do something a little bit different this morning, because this is a church where, according to our website and according to everything we say, thinking aloud is allowed. Thinking aloud is good and thinking aloud is allowed. Helen and I spend a lot of our time feeling we facilitate conversations of other people thinking aloud. And so we thought, well, we would start a conversation today or sow some seeds for some conversation. And we're going to do our thinking aloud, which you are going to allow us to do today. So we're not inviting response. We're just going to do some thinking and reflecting. And we thought particularly for some time that we need to have some conversation around issues of gender and identity in relation to church. COVID's got in the way, unfortunately, and so it's upset our planning over the last couple of years. But we're very aware that the world our kids are growing up in, things are taken for granted and accepted as very normal, and yet within the church, for some reason, these are things it's not good to talk about. I don't know why. A lot of the world is very different from the world that we as adults grew up in as well. So I guess conversations that will help us maybe as a church navigate some of the space rather than burying heads in the sand, which I think is what there's a tendency to do. So we wanted to offer some preliminary thoughts. And so Helen's going to be the first preliminary thinker.
Yeah, it wasn't really intended to be a sort of dump and run that we both leave the jobs and say this as we walk out the door. And so it was a COVID timing thing rather than a farewell. So we've both written ours separately, so mine's got a little bit of introduction, but I don't know what Peter's going to say, and he doesn't know how I'm going to go, so we'll see where we end up. I'm really pleased that we get to think aloud about these topics, and I'm really aware that within this room there are a range of opinions about them. And when I look around, I see people who love Jesus, who love people, and who want to live faithfully. And I know that in some ways that's how we kind of have handled it a little bit at Ilam, is that we haven't pushed talking about it, focusing instead on trying to make space for the differences that we have. And like Peter said, I think the reason that we have a growing sense that we need to talk about this is for our young people. The world they are living in is very different from the one we grew up in. Rather than predominantly two distinct groups, gender is understood as a spectrum. Rather than only ever seeing heterosexual relationships on TV or TikTok, we are now seeing slowly increasing diverse types of relationships being shown. And many of the Christian voices they hear are saying these things are wrong because the Bible says. And yet they may be experiencing these things within themselves or journeying with their friends, and they might be wondering whether the things that feel true inside of them are not okay with God. I remember one of the first times that I had a strong sense of God's love. I was in my flat in Palmerston North when I was studying. I was listening to Van Morrison and I was reading Henry Nouwen's Life of the Beloved. I think it was the first time I got a glimpse of the depth of God's love for each of us. And I know I go on about it, but the passage when Jesus is baptized and the Holy Spirit descends on him like a dove, God the Father's voice rings out from heaven, "This is my Son, my beloved, in whom I am so pleased." And I believe that that is the way that all of God looks at each of us. Another time I experienced this sense of God's love was during communion times when I worked at the Alternative Monday Night Fellowship at Delta Community Support Trust. We celebrated communion weekly, and seeing everyone come up each week, receive the bread and the juice in the midst of all the hard stuff that so many people were going through. I saw the suffering Jesus who identified with people in their pain and was with them, so deeply with them, giving them the hope and strength to get through the next week. Reading the Horizontal Epistles of Andromeda Veil by Adrian Plass was another formative time for me. Need to ask me about coots sometime. And so this is the baseline of how I understand God: deeply present, deeply loving, and deeply fond of each one of us. And when I come to the Bible, I see it through the eyes of this loving God. It is more reasonable for me to understand the book of Job as an allegory, is a play, is they're not a literal fight between God and Satan on who can hurt Job the most. It makes more sense for me to see the Bible as a community library that tells the stories of people trying to know God and to understand how they work in the community, rather than a literal description of God choosing the genocide of one group to give land to another. I guess for me, when science helps us understand that attraction or identity is something that is happening within our brains, then that understanding adds to our experience of the world God created. I hold that God created. I remember a line from Obadiah and the Minor Prophets, who is an awesome band, that God created the world in 7 days, 700 billion years ago. In other words, the point is that God created, not that the world Bible describes scientifically how it happened. I believe in evolution, in the Earth orbiting the sun, and around Earth, and I believe that people are, to quote Lady Gaga, born this way. I love the Bible. I love the way it points to Jesus and shows us a community of people trying to figure out how to follow God faithfully in their ordinary, everyday lives. Paul and co. are going from Jerusalem into Judea and into the outermost parts of the earth to tell people about the love of God. And as they go, at almost every step, God stretches them and invites them to open their arms wider and wider to embrace more of God's love for the whole world. You think my love is not for these people? Think again. You think these people are outside of my love? See, there is more. It's bigger, deeper, wider, more vast than you can imagine. I hate the way the Bible is used to draw lines around who gets in and who is out with God. How people use it to justify their way of living and squash down others. We're currently watching it used as a tool of white supremacy, anti-vax and extreme right-wing politics, if we follow the American political landscape. And even in New Zealand too. It's been used to affirm slavery, segregation, and the stealing of land from Indigenous communities. It is a brutal, blunt weapon when separated from the love of God. And I strongly and passionately step away from the verses that say women shouldn't lead or even speak in church. The verses that have been used to subjugate women and meant that church has missed the prophetic voices of so many. And that still carries on today. I joyously understand it as something that is wrong. It's a reflection of people in the prevailing culture and not the voice of God. And I strongly and passionately say that slavery is wrong, was wrong, will always be wrong, even when it was acceptable and the Bible was used to justify it. And I strongly deny that a person's skin colour or where they were born has any bearing on their humanity or on God's love for them. And I think we all do. I've read books by biblical scholars who are sure that the Bible says that homosexual relationships are wrong. And I've read books that say that same-sex attraction happens, but those who are attracted this way must remain celibate. And they use biblical scholarship to justify this position. And other biblical scholars who love and respect the Bible just as much and who say that LGBTQAI+ is just part of the way you were created by God. And each can argue their position using proof texts until they're blue in the face. It is so tricky when we're trying to read a book when the original languages are unfamiliar to us, the context and culture we know some of but not all of, and we don't know the author's intent always. You probably know this about me, but apologetics leave me cold. Using the Bible to prove God exists or how the world works is not how I understand God or experience the world around me. The ways that I have experienced God's love, that deep knowing, is more convincing for me any time. And I've read many other stories of how people have become affirming in many different ways because of a relative or a friend coming out. For those who see the bad fruit when beloved children who are LGBTQAI+ have very high rates of suicide or devastating hatred, when providing love and acceptance can allow them to flourish. In many things, I may be wrong, but I will always err on the side of love. And we know the challenge for me in loving someone like Donald Trump and seeing him as beloved. And God's love is vaster than I can even imagine. And I'm very glad that God is God and not me. Barbara Brown Taylor says, "The only clear line I draw these days is, if my religion tries to come between me and my neighbour, I will choose my neighbour. That self-cancelling feature of my religion is one of the things I like best about it. Jesus never commanded me to love my religion." God is more loving than we can imagine. God is more merciful than we can imagine. God is bigger than I can even begin to grasp. And that love and mercy are what I carry with me as I move through this world, encountering people. And that's what I offer to myself as well. So that is where I come to as we talk about this topic. This world has changed so much. The world is always changing. We are all on a journey trying to figure out how to love God faithfully in our ordinary everyday lives. This is a conversation that is important for us to continue to have in ways that are safe for the people involved. And there are many, many resources around. We have some in our church library. You can find loads of them. I would love to commend to you a resource by another. She used to be a Baptist pastor. Her name is Amanda Pilbrow. She wrote her master's thesis on the experiences a number of LGBT people had in the church. And she has collated a whole lot of resources, including her thesis, on the website alreadyenough.co.nz. Love to encourage you to have a look. Our young people are amazing. My kids are teaching me about love, friendship, and supporting their friends as they figure out who they are in this world. I'm so grateful for them. I'm in awe of them, and I see each of them as beloved. We need to journey with this stuff because it's the world around us, and it's the world God loves so very much. And that, for me, is why that I am wholeheartedly affirming of LGBTQAI plus people and their place in God's family. And I know that there are a range of views and opinions within this space, and I'm glad that we are a community of deep relationship that can journey together with all that we are. Let's see.
So a slightly different tack from me, I guess. Just thinking back over, I have done the last few weeks of my own interactions with all these gender and identity questions. And thinking back to the world I grew up in, which of course, if I had much hair, you'd see is very grey. So I'm obviously a bit older, but as a teenager in school, it was the days where there was no formal sex education in school. So the words gay and other terms like them were used quite a lot in a single-sex boys' school, but always as terms of abuse for somebody you didn't like. They were not words because you actually thought somebody was gay. No one came out as gay in those days because back then it just wasn't acceptable, so therefore it was a very unsafe thing to acknowledge, admit, or to own up to. So that was my upbringing. So then I moved on to university, and I studied law. This was in England, and 1971 was when I started at Bristol University, and I remember very much first year we studied criminal law, and the Sexual Offences Act 1967 came up, which was the first piece of legislation in England that decriminalised homosexual acts between two men only in private if they were aged 21 or over. So suddenly in the public arena, the whole issue of homosexuality was at last being acknowledged to be acceptable, provided it was two adult men over 21 and in private. There was a long, long fought campaign to bring about that piece of legislation. And I recall very much that the sort of opinions being put forward were along the lines that homosexuals were disgusting people. And that was the world in the 1960s and earlier. It's hard to imagine today that that is what it was like, but it was. That was the view of many people when I was the age of you IBY people and students. I arrived in New Zealand with Carol when she brought me here in January 1984 to a slightly different world from England, where homosexual acts were still criminal in New Zealand in 1984. Same-sex love was still illegal. Probably most of you adults were only just coming out of your cots around that time, is that right? But it was only in 1986 that the New Zealand Homosexual Law Reform Act was passed, which decriminalised homosexual acts between men aged over the age of 16. So that was about it for the early years of homosexuality. Notice that the law never had anything to say about female same-sex relationships. It was only about men. That was what was abhorrent and what society viewed as disgusting. In law school, going back again a few years, we also studied family law and the law around marriage. And there was a case that was one of the first that we had to study, legal case, called Corbett and Corbett in 1970. In England, it was legal for people to go through sex change operations. But the question that came up in this case of Corbett was whether or not, having changed sex, you could then enter into a valid marriage. And April Ashley, as she became known, had undergone a sex change operation in 1960. She had, with the consent of the person she married, entered into a valid marriage, but then he thought better of it and he wanted to have the marriage annulled, which basically means it's a bit like a divorce, only getting the court to say the marriage never happened in the first place. And of course, good law, the lawyers, the court has to decide whether a relationship between a man and a woman includes some sex, somebody who is transgender. Gender reassignment. But it was found that there was no valid marriage, that although she had gone through a gender reassignment that was valid in terms of medical procedure, in terms of marriage, she was not allowed to marry as a woman. Gosh, you know, it's hard, isn't it? I mean, I kind of see you looking at me as if I'm bonkers or whatever, but you know, this is the way the world was back not all that long ago. And I kind of thought it was worth going there because as I look back on it, I have a lot of hope because the world has changed significantly. Attitudes have changed. And so I think it's always important to remember that change does happen. Things will always get incrementally better. It takes some time for public opinion to change. But when public opinion changed back in the 1960s, the law then had to change to follow it. So the law always lags behind public opinion. Don't complain about it, because the law has to be a little bit conservative. It has to preserve the status quo, but then it changes. I think the sad thing I've discovered is, as a pastor and church leader over the years, that whereas the law takes a lot longer to get around to recognizing change, the church takes even longer. And probably, again, theologians would say for very good reason. God doesn't change, so we have to be careful to say that society and the way society views things needs to change the way we approach our theology. But eventually we do, because many of you may remember that back in the 1950s and 1960s, divorced people were not recognized in the church. And the churches would never remarry a divorced person. Now, who thinks about divorce today? Who ever begins to question whether or not it's okay to be divorced and a Christian and remarry and be part of a church? It's just taken for granted that, of course, we've moved on. So there is hope. Want to change tack and go into a Jesus story, because for me, when I encounter Jesus, I'm always challenged. And as I was thinking about this, my reading in the week I'd started my thinking was from Luke 14, at the beginning of Luke 14. And it's an account of Jesus interacting with the religious leaders of his time. And I think it's important to deliberately allow Jesus to confront us, because our attitudes sometimes need to be re-examined. So this is Jesus. One Sabbath, we read, Jesus went to a meal in the house of a leading Pharisee, but they were keeping a close eye on him. So this is like going to lunch, Sunday lunch, after a church service, except this wasn't going to be a very warm, welcoming sort of meal, because the Pharisees were the leading religious leaders of the time, and you'd have to be pretty important to be invited to this lunch. So Jesus was obviously worthy of an invitation, but it wasn't a comfortable place for him to be because everyone there, all the religious leaders, we're told, were keeping an eye on him, watching for him to put a foot wrong. So a bit of a tense lunch. I don't think I'd be wanting to snap up an invitation of that sort after church. So if you want to invite us, you're very welcome, but not on the basis you want to test us. But at this lunch, there was a man there in front of Jesus who suffered from dropsy. We don't know who the man was or why he was there at the meal. Dropsy probably was some sort of condition that involved fluid retention, so he was probably looking a bit bloated and full in some areas of his body. He was visibly unwell, though. He could have been planted there by the Pharisees just to see how Jesus would respond. But here is this poor man who is suffering visibly, who is there in front of Jesus. And Jesus responds, but he does so with a question to the Pharisees and the religious leaders who are there with him. So Jesus asked the lawyers and Pharisees, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not? They remained silent. Jesus took the man, healed him, and dismissed him. Then he said to them, suppose one of you has a son or an ox that falls into a well. Are you going to tell me that you won't pull him straight away on the Sabbath day? They had no answer for that. There are at least two things going on here. You see, in those times, the Jewish religious leaders would have had a real problem with Jesus healing full stop, regardless of the day of the week, because in Jewish religious thought, illnesses and disabilities were punishments from God. Punishment for sin, and therefore they were to be accepted and endured. Now that was the view at the time. It's not the view of contemporary Jewish thinking, but back in Jesus' time, if you were ill, it was God's punishment, you accepted it, you endured it. It was God's will for you. So healing was confronting for the Pharisees. But they had an even bigger problem, though, and that was Jesus healing on the Sabbath day. Because as good Bible scholars as we are, we know that the Jewish law said that no one was to do any work on the Sabbath, and healing was regarded as work. So the Jewish leaders had an attitude problem around healing, and they had a legal problem about the religious laws of the Sabbath. Notice, though, the way Jesus handles the situation. He knows what's going on in their minds, and he asks them a question, which either they cannot answer or they choose not to answer, because anyone with a heart would know the answer, but as leaders, they can't be seen to acknowledge it. The answer that they are afraid to have, to own up to, is that compassion and love are more important than the letter of the religious laws. After all, as Jesus points out, they would have rescued their son or their ox if it had fallen into a well on the Sabbath. So if you know your Gospels, you will know that this isn't the only account of Jesus doing something that was frowned on the Sabbath. But everything we see in Jesus' ministry embodies a truth that love for people is more important than anything else apart from our love for God. Do you remember the great commandment, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor, other people, as yourself. The Jews, in this extract we read in Luke, wanted to live by the rules. But the Jesus way is to have concern for people and their well-being and their flourishing. And so I guess Jesus is showing us that compassion and love for people trump religious rules. So let's put Jesus on one side. I wanted to just share that story with you. As you realize, it's not a story about LGBTQ whatever at all, is it? It has nothing to do with that. And why? Because people were not asking Jesus questions about that in his ministry that we read in the Gospels. But it does remind us that for Jesus, religious rules were not there to provide boundaries. They were not there to stop people coming to Christ, to finding God, finding fullness of life. And that's a point he was making again and again. So let's come on to today, because as Helen reminded us, that science and experience of people have shown us a lot more about the nature of gender than certainly was known back in the 1960s when I was growing up. We do understand now that there is not a simple binary division between male and female. And I love the fact that when we read Genesis, and it says that God made humans in his own image, male and female, he created them, we're beginning to see that, that is a spectrum. There's a sense that there is a maleness and a femaleness and a whole spectrum in between, that God made people, some all along that spectrum, but they are part of God's creation, which he saw was good. We're learning a lot today about same-sex attraction. We're discovering that one's noted gender at birth is not necessarily the way that one grows up in terms of one's identity. Human beings are complex. We are fearfully and wonderfully made, and our complexity and differences are something that we need to celebrate as being part of the creation, which Genesis tells us God declared to be good. People are to be celebrated no matter who they are. Many sections of the church today, by which I mean the wider church, find it convenient to hide behind what they regard as the rules in the Bible, as if the Bible was a scientific treatise, or as if the Bible has the answers to every question or every problem which humanity has ever faced and will ever face. But the Bible is not intended to be that. It was never intended to be that. It's not an encyclopedia of all knowledge. It tells us who God is, and it tells us of the interaction of God with humanity. And from that, we can learn so much about what is and what needs to be. But we don't look at the Bible for the rules. I think if we want to rely on the Bible, we will find that although it does on a couple of occasions mention male same-sex relations, it actually has nothing specifically to say about female same-sexual relations. It has nothing to say about bisexual relations. It has nothing to say about the status of being transgender, or any other gender identities or sexual orientations. We can't find that information in the Bible because it's not there. People's biblical perspectives on male same-sex relationships are often formed largely from the book of Leviticus and some bits from Paul in Romans and elsewhere. I'm not going to dwell in the text. As Helen said, you can find scholars who will interpret texts in different ways. Everybody is grappling with the same information, and you can choose your camp and you can find, I guess, the arguments you want. And there's plenty of resources out there to help us do so. I did just want to note, though, that Leviticus chapter 20 makes it clear that if two men were to lie together, it would be an abomination and they should be put to death. Which is interesting because there are many other so-called abominations in the Old Testament, and I'm not aware that we pay any attention to them at all. For some reason, the only one we're interested in is male same-sex relations. And also, if you are familiar with your Old Testament, you'll discover that there are a lot of other reasons given for people to be stoned or put to death, including for doing work on the Sabbath, and I'm not aware that we take account of those either. You may like to have a look to see if you feel that you want to pick up some stones and hurl them at people. You'll find plenty of reasons why people can be stoned to death. We choose only, though, to acknowledge one in particular, because that is a context we want to find ammunition for a fight. I guess that what I'm saying is that I don't think that the Bible, especially the Old Testament, is necessarily very helpful in terms of helping us understand questions of gender identity and same-sex attractions. But what the Bible does do is point us to Jesus Christ, Son of God. And Jesus shows us that God's heart is for people, that humans are valued, desired, and loved by Almighty God, no matter who they are. And that as those who say we are followers of Christ, we should not be putting barriers into the way of people coming to Christ and finding Christ for themselves, People matter. And for me, journeying with people, this is what I've tried to live out through a whole lot of different situations. I've been a pastor on and off in different situations, different contexts. I remember the son of one of the elders in a church that I was part of who came out as gay via the weekend New Zealand Herald Canvas magazine in glorious Technicolor. He announced to the world that he was gay with an article about him. Total shock to his parents and the church. That was somebody I needed to journey with. I remember the older leader who was outed when he became sick and went into hospital for tests and was found to be HIV positive. Total surprise and shock to everybody. But there was a situation where a lot of people needed to be journeyed through very sensitively, including the person at the heart of it themselves. And there have been others, people who have struggled, people who've been comfortable, but issues of identity have not been easy in the church. I've tried to journey well alongside people grappling with identity issues. I'm not sure that I've always got it right, but the church at large has not always been a safe place for people who are different or are unsure where they fit. I'm not a theologian, but I'm a pastor. And for me, that means people are my priority. And I have to start with the person in front of me and where they are at and affirm for them and with them and to them that they are loved by God and they are important to God and that God desires to journey with them. And I believe that is what Jesus is pointing us to as we read passages like the one that I've referred to this morning. People matter to Jesus more than any rules that we want to formulate to keep them away. A few weeks back, we had a staff lunch to farewell Helen and to welcome Margaret. And we were having that at a cafe not too far from here, owned by some people not totally disassociated with Island Baptist Church. You'll be familiar with the cafe in Lincoln Road. If you're not, have a word with me afterwards. It's a great place to go. But we were struck by the, Steph and I were, we were sitting next to each other, and opposite us is a TV screen with a number of advertisements playing out. And we were both struck by the depiction there, the reminder that this was a venue that is linked to the Safe Spaces Alliance. And the Safe Spaces Alliance is a grouping of organizations that indicate that their organization is a safe place for people to be, no matter what their identity, no matter what they are going through, no matter who they are. This is an environment where you are safe. And I guess as I saw that and as I think about Islam, and yes, I will be finishing my role here in a couple of weeks' time, but my dream has been, and my dream still is, that Islam will be a safe space, most especially for our young people growing up in our midst. No matter what they encounter, no matter how they identify, I want our young people at Islam to know that they are safe in this community and they are loved. And that they, I want them to come to know and experience the deep love that God has for them. I don't want us as a community to put any barriers in the way of them coming to that place in their lives. And I would so love it if others who come to Islam will find the same, that we are a welcoming community, accepting and loving. We have to recognize that we can't be all things to all people, but we can do all that we can to love and accept people. My dream goes a little bit further. I'd love to get to a place where we actually don't have to have conversations around this. Not because I want to sweep the conversation under the carpet, but because I would love us to be so accepting and so over it that it was just normal, normal life at all. Within the church, what we are or how we identify shouldn't be important. I'd love us to be at a place in the church at large, I mean, not just Ireland, where every person is valued, accepted, and loved, without having to identify to other people whether they're gay, lesbian, bisexual, Indian, Maori, wealthy, or whatever. I would like us just to be able to be loved and accepted for who we are. So I have a little bit more hope than Kelly when I see Galatians 3:28. And I just wanted to sort of quote it just to finish with, because I love the fact that Paul says there is no longer Jew or Greek. There is no longer slave or free. There is no male and female. You are all one in the Messiah, Jesus. That would be my dream, that as church, we acknowledge and live out that sort of oneness, and that we don't have to state our differences, but we are accepted regardless of who we are. We can just bowl up to people maybe in a funny sort of way and say, "Hi, I'm Peter. I kind of love and try to follow Jesus. It's great to meet you. Welcome to Ireland. Welcome to the church," whatever. But without having to sort of say who we are and where we identify. Now, I want to acknowledge that conversations around this stuff for many people can be very, very hard. Not so hard for our younger people, because it's a different world, as Helen has explained. But it can be uncomfortable, because we may be forced to re-examine our own attitudes, or even go back and read the Bible carefully for ourselves rather than reading the opinions of others. But we have strong values at ILM that I think point us to the need to do this spaciously, lovingly, and carefully, because we say that we value being a community where everyone experiences grace, where everyone feels loved and wanted, connected to each other and with God. We're a community that affirms each other in our joys and sorrows, struggles, strengths and weaknesses, allowing our true selves to be known so that we can be Christ for each other. It's all there in our DNA, in who we are as a community. But in conversations which maybe flow on in the future, how about we recognize those values and listen respectfully and lovingly and carefully to each other? So that's my reflections on however many years as a pastor and other things I've done in my life. The world is changing. The church changes. And I actually believe that in 20 years' time, we will not be having these conversations in the church, because things will have moved on. And I long for that day to come. But I think we need to do the I think we need to take responsibility for doing some work on this and getting it right. But that's all.